Andy Martino, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Ron, thanks for having me.
So you have an envious position for many would think so, many Yankee fans would think so, of being able to go to Yankee games day after day and cover the team. The book is The Yankee Way, the Untold Inside Story of the Brian Cashman Era. And in this, I don't know if it's even still the time of Moneyball. Moneyball came out 20, 25 years ago, and it keeps updating. Everybody refers to Moneyball. It's certainly a classic. And I guess this is, in a way, the Yankee version of Moneyball.
Interesting. Certainly in the spirit of how the front office sausage is made, I suppose it is, and what their front office philosophies are and sets of beliefs, it is, in a sense. It covers obviously a different era, a different kind of span than Moneyball, which focused heavily on, I think it was the 2002 season on Oakland and Billy Beane. And I tried my best to use a canvas here that was basically all Yankee history, but focusing in on the 70s, 80s, 90s to present, and how they've had continuity in their front office that is unparalleled. Whether one likes how they do business or not, there's no debating that they have greater continuity than any other organization right now in baseball ops. So that, to me, made them a lens to look at the game and the changes in the game in that time. And I guess in that sense, maybe it's in the spirit of Moneyball too, in that it's trying to capture some changes that have happened in philosophies of how front offices operate. In Cashman's case, many waves of changes.
It's interesting the way you use the word continuity, because certainly working for George Steinbrenner, there's no guarantee of continuity. But it is also quite an education of learning how the Yankees have gone through their series of general managers and front office personnel until, if I remember correctly, Cashman is the longest tenured general manager in the history of the franchise.
That's correct.
And the staying power in any job these days is certainly amazing, but certainly for the Yankees in New York, under that kind of lens, under that kind of microscope, is something to be praised. In the introduction of the book, your notes, you note that you started working in this book in earnest. I use that word earnest in 2021. So that means that you had been thinking about this for a while.
Good question. Good catch on the word choice there. Yes. Well, what I meant by in earnest are two different things. One is that I've been covering this team. A lot of this material in here comes from being around and reporting on the team for many years as a baseball reporter and writer in New York. So I maybe wasn't intentionally working on the project or aware that I would be writing a book about this in 2017 or what have you, but I was already gathering material just by being there, doing my job. So there's that, which I meant by that. But also, you mentioned something I've been thinking about for a while. I actually was a graduate student in journalism in 2007 and 8, and we had to do a master's project, they called it, and mine was a long form piece of journalism about how Cashman had taken over full control of baseball operations after the 05 season when he w was ready to quit, and then Steinbrenner gave him control, and he brought in different ideas about pro scouting. He brought in the mental skills coach, which is who is still there. He buffed up the analytics, and post Moneyball gave the Yankees a presence in that world, which they ultimately expanded. So I was interested in the Cashman administration as a subject ever since then, and it had been in the back of my mind all that time, maybe to give it a fuller length treatment.
Did you have, tell us about the process of shopping this around, of looking for a publisher?
Well, I'm very fortunate to have worked with Doubleday and have worked with Doubleday on two previous books. One was one that I wrote called Cheated, where I had an editor there, Jason Kaufman, who was very easy to work with. And then I whatever you'd call it, ghost wrote Kenny Smith's memoir after that, in 2023, I think it came out, also with Doubleday and Jason Kaufman. So when you're fortunate enough to get into these relationships, you can, pitch to them directly. So I actually didn't really shop the proposal so much as it was in a great ongoing conversation with my editor about next projects. And the reason this went back more top of mind, Ron, probably now that I'm thinking this through, is that in writing Cheated, which was about the sign stealing era and the Astros scandal, I did a deep dive into the Yankee front office because a secondary plot line of that book is how the Yankees and Dodgers felt like they built everything up the right way for that era, only to be thwarted by the cheating Astros and postseasons. And so I did a lot of work on how Cashman and his people built up that this team, that era of the Yankees, and how they ultimately felt cheated by it. And so then when you're looking for your next book and you're having a conversation, I just thought there's even more there with this group, this baseball ops group with the Yankees. It would be an interesting story to tell. So that's kind of how it came about. And as I said, it was more just a conversation with Doubleday than a shopping a proposal kind of process.
By coincidence, the next interview I'll be conducting is with Andy McCullough, who just wrote a book about Clayton Kershaw. And of course, a big part of that is the cheating that went on in that World Series.
Which is a great book, by the way. I assume you've read it if you're going to interview Andy. And I really enjoyed that one. He's a talented writer.
And it's certainly the subject, as someone of my age who's been following baseball for a long time, they don't make them like Kershaw anymore. You know, the era of the stud pitcher who can throw 250 innings a year and compile 275, 300 wins is, I don't think we'll ever see that again. Getting back to your project, since you have been following the Yankees so much for so long, talk about Cheated a little bit. And that's a team that you hadn't been following. What there was the research in that like compared to some project like this?
Great question too. So that book, what really compelled me about, I had done some, I'll back up a little. I had done some reporting on the Astros and their suspected sign stealing prior to the Athletic speaking to the pitcher, Mike Fiers, who went on the record about the trash cans and everything. So I'd been working on this story on my own. You know, plenty of baseball reporters were. It was known to an extent what the Astros were doing, and we were working on it. So I had some legwork there. When the scandal blew up, I was already connected to it that way. But in terms of process, what really interested me on the same series of a few days, certainly within 1 week in January 2020, three really well-respected and one promised, two well-respected and one promising manager lost their jobs, A.J. Hinch, Alex Cora, and Carlos Beltran. And that was actually my in terms of interest and sourcing and storytelling there, wasn't so much the whole breadth of the scandal, but wow, this thing is so big. The two World Series winning managers and one amazing baseball guy in Beltran are now out on the street, out of work. And that was what's got me going. I know these three guys to different extents, but I thought that was what interested me. So if you really look at that book, it's a lot about the three managers. And that's how that was my thread there. And then once I got reporting, it was so much fun to unspool the history of sign stealing scandals throughout the history of the game and how sometimes they're very funny. Sometimes they help you put what the Astros did in context for better and for worse. And then just once you're digging in on something, then I sort of built up a little bit more of the sourcing to report on what the Astros actually did, that they were cheating during the World Series in 17, that they were still doing things in 19. But my in there, I think, to your original question, was the interest in the managers. And wow, geez, those three guys all lost their jobs this week. That's what got me started on that.
The Yankee way, since, again, you have been covering this team for so long and you have accumulated a vast source of information, both between your writing, the people you know, your contacts. How difficult was it to pare down the original manuscript into what the finished product was?
I'm not one that writes 150,000 words when I need 90. So not that difficult. I'd like to tell you that I had a whole other, you know, half a book of great material that I left on the cutting room floor. But Ron, the way I'm no veteran at this, I've written three books and I kind of know when I'm done. There's plenty more that you could put in there, but a really important quality for a book to me is accessibility and holding the reader's attention. And I've read so much, this is a bit of a tangential answer to your question, but I've read so much nonfiction that's acclaimed and popular that's boring, frankly, or just over the course of my life and overstuffed, that I'm always trying to streamline books and say, okay, what do I need to tell the reader So I wasn't gathering a whole lot of extra. Once you gather and gather and gather, sometimes as a writer, you feel like you got to put it all in there because you went out and gathered it, and you lose your judgment. So I cut maybe 5 to 10,000 words that I didn't think were up to snuff. But I really try to keep these things relatively tight and sort of think like that the whole way. And when you round that, this book was, I think, 95,000 words. And you round that turn, when you get to around 80, you're like, all right, I'm landing the plane now. I'm wrapping it up. That's just my answer to process that way, I guess.
No, it's interesting because, like you, I've written three books and I feel the same way. I'm not one for over, you get to the meat of the matter. You don't drag it out. You're not getting paid by the word for this. So now you are a reporter, so you are used to writing tight. And how hard is that compared? Now, how hard is writing a book compared with that? Because although in the age of the internet, as opposed to print media, where, in print media, your editor tells you, I need 800 words, I need 1,000 words. On the internet, you have a little more space, for lack of a better comparison. But when you're writing a book, you're kind of free ranging.
That's true. I loved it. Although you have to make sure you stay disciplined and rein yourself in for the reasons that we just discussed, keeping it tight. But there is room within a book to say, I want to do an aside here, one graph. I want to go into a parenthetical here. I want to, and you do have the space, so that's fun. Again, as long as you don't overdo it, keep a tight leash on yourself. But coming up in print, which I did, the New York Daily News and the Philadelphia Inquirer really, really helped. Because it teaches you to keep it tight. And honestly, with the proliferation of online journalism in the maybe around 2010-ish, when long form became this buzzword, that's unfortunately for people's jobs is pulled back now, probably. But I just always felt like a lot of things are too long. Even if they can, just because they can be doesn't mean they have to be. I always feel like I have to earn the reader's continued attention with every sentence, every graph. So I always appreciated the 800 to 1,000 word column online to the 3,000 word feature, honestly, unless you earned every one of those 3,000 words. So coming up in print helps you keep it tight that way. And then with a book, you're just doing a lot of that on one topic for much longer. A great piece of advice I got was from a friend of mine and a New York Times bestselling baseball author, Tim Brown, who said, you just sit down and write a column every day. And, after about 6 months or a year or what have you, you have a book. So it helps to demystify the process a little, to think of it not that dissimilarly to when you're writing in newspapers. So that helps. And then the last thing I'll say, real specific to me, but I had an opportunity at the New York Daily News to kind of join a long form team for a while, where I was producing 3 to 5,000 word pieces maybe once a month, and that was my job for a year or two. And really, all I'm doing at the book is writing those individual 3 to 5,000 word features as chapters. They're relatively self-contained, the chapters in the books that I've written. So doing like that length of journalism really helps learn how to write a chapter. And then you write a book outline, it's what, 12 to 15 of those, and you have a book. I don't mean to make it sound so simple, but it kind of is.
I'm just wondering, do you think part of that is, you always hear that the younger generation has a short attention span, the designation too long didn't read. Do you think that applies to contemporary authors now more so than in the past?
It must have a trickle-down effect. I mean, I don't have any data to prove it, but I know that, I mean, books have withstood so many changes in technology over so many centuries, right? And I know that my 12-year-old likes books, even though he spends too much time on screens. And I worry about his and his attention span of him and his peers. But an engaging book can still engage a kid. I can know that from being a parent of kids right now. But yeah, probably to your question, I would think that it's got us all to tighten it up a little bit in the author realm. I would like to think that I would be economical and try to be engaging no matter what the current attention span was of the youth of America. But it probably does push to where I haven't written like a 50 to 60,000 word book, but I would think that with the current attention spans being shorter, there might be something to be said for even a shorter book, as long as every word, as long as you weren't cutting things that were important and every word mattered. Yeah, it's probably harder to hold people's attention, and you're probably not doing yourself any favors by writing a big doorstopper anymore. That would be my off the cuff answer to that question.
The again comparing the Yankee way with cheated. Cheated was a one time specific, well, one time. It was a specific event. And I imagine you see a lot of these books come out that are based on a one time single event. Timing is important because you can't come back 10 years later and write about something like this and expect people to jump on it the way a book like The Yankee Way, which covers decades, it is more of a historical component. Yankee fans and fans, not just Yankee fans. I mean, I'm not a Yankee fan, but I appreciate the history, and the comparisons made between the different eras, first under George Steinbrenner and then, his family afterwards, and the differences in how business was done. But did you feel any extra pressure with Cheated to get it done quickly?
I did, and I was so used to the daily news reporting pace that actually I finished it in June of 2020. The pandemic helped. I had more time to write. I wrote it during that quarantine time, probably accelerated a little, but it came out in June of 21. And I remember, since you asked, I remember going to my great editor Jason Kaufman going, now, can we, like, I got stuff in here that's newsy. Is there any way to print it, get it out fast? Does it have to be June of 21? And he's going, relax, this is how we do things. And it was fine. But I take your point that and I did feel that stress and pressure. And to be honest with you, there were sort of little mini scoops in there that got scooped between the time I wrote it and the time it came out, because it's a competitive environment. Not huge things, but yeah, that wasn't the easiest part about it. And it's one of the reasons why I chose a book that was a little more evergreen, to be honest with you, as the next project, to not be so newsy and competitive in that way. Actually, that did play into the topic selection of the Yankee Way.
Your ghostwriting project, I don't know if readers appreciate the difficulties in working in something like that, because in a sense, it is not your book. It
Right.
is your subject's book, and you have to go back and forth with your subject. How did that process work between you and Smith?
So he knew what he wanted to say, which helped a lot. He knew he needed a professional writer. So basically, I'll give you the real nuts and bolts of it. He would write up a little, we organized it in chapters. It was the people who had influence on him. So there's a chapter on Jordan, a chapter on Dean Smith, a chapter on Magic Johnson. So we'd get to each of these figures, and he would send me a draft of his thoughts about the person in question, and I'd read it, and I would use that to interview him about this person. So then we'd roll tape on an interview. This was during the pandemic, so it was almost all Zoom. So I'd read what he had to say, I'd process it, I'd write questions, we'd have a conversation about it. I would have the conversation transcribed, and then I would take the interview and his own writing and try to stitch them together in a first person narrative that captured his voice. It was a really fun creative challenge. I felt a tremendous sense of responsibility because this is his book, this is his life story. It's important to him. Got to get it right. Got to do right by him. He picked me to help him with it. But I also felt that some of the pressure was off because as a writer, we're so self-obsessed and you want everything. I don't know how you think, but Ron, but you want everything to be great that you turn out and all, this is my work. And when it's someone else's, you're a little bit removed for it in a way that actually frees you up to do a nice job because you're not feeling that same exact type of pressure. So I quite enjoyed it. And just the experience of being able to help someone else draw out their voice is cool, because writing's not usually collaborative. It's usually solitary and lonesome, right? So that was kind of fun about that. I quite enjoyed it, helping him find his voice. Because as you and I both know, we may have a speaking voice and a conversational voice, but to get that down on paper is much harder than people think. Just to write in a way that sounds like you is hard. And it was fun to help someone with that.
And it obviously turned out well for both of you because we have the book to prove it. Getting back to the Yankee way, you mentioned specifically that you didn't have the, for lack of a better word, cooperation of Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez. Why did you think that was important? Not to say that you didn't have it, but why do you think their participation was particularly important?
Well, there was just, it was the basic journalistic principle of there's enough said about them, not all of it positive, that you want to give everybody every chance to air their own perspective or object to anything that's written. I've gotten feedback from readers that it's not the most flattering portrayal of Jeter or A-Rod. I wasn't intending to make it flattering or unflattering. I was trying to lay out the facts as I was understood them, but I understood that it could be seen that way. So it's important as ethically to make every effort to let them talk. As it says in the author's note, they declined through representatives. So obviously I spoke to the representatives. You do everything you can to get that perspective. I was fortunate in that Jeter had done his own extensive interviewing for his own documentary a year prior. So I could draw from some of his own insights about himself from that and about Cashman. But it's important anytime you're telling a story. It's a fuller narrative the more people that you talk to who are involved, and it's just basic fairness. But they chose not to be interviewed, and of course, that's their right.
I was watching a game the other night, and I forget what, I know it wasn't the regular network. It was either ESPN or MLB or Fox. I'm not sure. Oh, it might have been the game between the Mets and Phillies in London. I don't really can't remember. But I found it almost a little jarring that Rodriguez and Jeter were on the broadcasting team, and
The Yankees find it jarring too.
I was wondering how comfortable each of them felt having to work with each other. You mention here that Cashman didn't want the book to be about him. Am I remembering correctly?
He didn't
How
want it to be
difficult?
about him. You go ahead with your question,
No,
Ron.
I
Sorry.
was going to say, how difficult was that when you came up with this project? Exactly what, I mean, did you want this to be a book about Cashman? Did you want this to be a book about his reign with the Yankees? Because you do go back and explain, the preface of the people who came before him. What exactly, when you first thought of this project, did you want it to be? And is that the way it turned out?
Good question. I wanted it to be about his tenure as running and being involved in baseball operations because I knew, because of the continuity we spoke of before, I felt that A, there was a broader story about the arc of the sport to tell that I could only tell through the Yankees because of that kind of his mentors being with the organization since the 60s and 70s. And he's with the 2024 Yankees. It's the only organization where you can say they made this movie yesterday because of a person's ideas who died in 1980. There's such a continuity there. It was about more than Cashman. It was about their whole operation. I wanted it to be about that. And I know that Cashman's a compelling character in a lot of ways, who's had some very public cursing out his players and telling their stories about him that are interesting too. So I wanted Cashman to be a primary character in a story about Yankees baseball ops. I did not want it to be a biography. I don't think he's a subject where I would pitch a biography about him. If you read the book, you don't know in the book if what his family situation is. You don't know. You know a little bit about his father and how that is relevant to connecting with George Steinbrenner, but it's not a book about his life. You don't know about his siblings. You don't know about anything that'd be in a biography. He and I were fortunately aligned in that when I was trying to convince him to be interviewed extensively. He was very reluctant anyway because he didn't want any appearance that he had a book project going. Was not the right time for him. So what I wanted was a piece of reporting that interviewed him at length, but many others. And that was the only thing that he was going to be willing to agree to. So fortunately, for different purposes, we had the same need for me to be independent on this. So that is what I envisioned. And it did play out like I envisioned. The final product was not some surprising left turn from what I thought it would be. It was basically what I thought it would be, and that's big for better or worse. Whether it worked or not is for other people to say, but it was executing the idea that I had.
Considering how much you've been covering the team for all the years, Was there anything surprising that you found during your construction?
I didn't know the story of the falling out between Cashman and Joe Torre, and how it was over the use of a reliever who hardly pitched in the big leagues. That was surprising. Some of the depths of the suspicion between A-Rod and Jeter was interesting. There was that famous New York Post cover that said Stray Rod, Alex photographed with Mystery Blonde in Toronto back in 2007. And I didn't know that there were people in the Yankee clubhouse saying, you know, Jeter tipped off those photographers. Jeter was behind this. He wasn't by any, there's no evidence that he was, but that was the level of the Cold War between them, that intense that that was even a plausible suggestion at the time. That surprised me. Anything else really surprised me? Well, I didn't know anything really about the philosophies of a guy named Bill Livesey, who is a major character in the book, who we all know about Gene Michael as part of the Yankee lore as a legendary mentor to Cashman and GM. But Bill Livesey is this other guy that was with the organization in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, who spearheaded this project of writing this Yankee Way manual, who ranked the tools for every position in order of importance in a way that the Yankees still use today. All this in the weeds baseball stuff that is so fascinating for me personally as a fan of the game. I didn't know any of it before going into this. So I was surprised that the Yankees value defense at the corner infield positions more than most organizations, or any other example of this. Like I said, in the weeds baseball ops stuff. All that was surprising to me and really, really fun to learn.
One of the things I did after reading about the manual, I went online to see if there was any way to get a physical copy of it anywhere, like on eBay.
Nope.
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 Believe me, I look too.
There are so many people, like you just mentioned, behind the scenes that do yeoman's work that never get this kind of credit. So kudos to you for giving someone like that a credit and letting the people who do appreciate this kind of depth. Rather than just, you know, reading the gossipy stuff, to give those people credit for the amazing job they've done in putting together this kind of franchise.
Well, thanks for saying that. The gossipy stuff, in a sense, I felt like what I was really doing was smuggling a lot of scouting and baseball ops, real nerdy technical stuff, into a book where there are headlines about Torre, Cashman, Jeter, A-Rod, right? There's that stuff, which isn't illegitimate. It was fun to report about that too. But what I was really passionate about, honestly, above all else, is this stuff and giving the unsung people credit. Because you look at an organization like the New York Yankees, where the story has been told a million times, if you can see a lane of, hey, this story hasn't been told, that's pretty exciting. That's what we do, right? You're trying to tell people things that they might not have been exposed to before. So that was really fun.
Well, certainly when you read stories about the Yankees, I mean, nobody is like born a Yankee. You know, they have to come up somehow. Someone has to scout them, someone has to sign them, someone has to train them. That was one of the interesting things about the Kershaw book, which I don't think I've ever read in any other book, is the depth behind his, I was going to say comeuppance, but that's not the right word. But his start
Everything that goes
as an
into it.
amateur and the depth that you didn't have this kind of coverage, not by the media, but by the scouts and the teams that you would have had 50, 60, 70 years ago. And how much is available to everyone now to find this stuff. Andy, I want to thank you very much for chatting with us today. Again, the book is The Yankee Way, The Untold Inside Story of the Brian Cashman Era. Highly recommended. Just one more thing before you go. You mentioned at one point a schedule of churning out a book. I have found that there are basically two major periods for releasing baseball books. One is for opening day, and then again for Father's Day.
That's right. Yeah, that's what I find too. I've had two
Thank
June, late June releases, so that's been the calendar that Doubleday's had me on.
you.
I'm grateful when anyone wants to publish anything I write whenever on the calendar. But yes, I agree. I've noticed that schedule too.
So, are you working on anything now that you
And
can
looking for the
chat
next
about?
idea. Looking for the next idea right now, truly. And I have a day job, which is covering the game, which I'm very fortunate to have as well. So I'm immersed in that for right now, and these ideas have to come organically. So I'm still looking for it, is the honest answer.
Well, we look forward to whatever you come up with. So, Andy,
Well,
thanks
thank you.
again, and good luck and enjoy the rest of the season.
Thanks, Ron. I appreciate it.